Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about LynStore, a great way to replicate your data across the cluster. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 494, recorded August 22nd, 2018, LynStore. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after the show and play with it. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be back. I always like being called lovely and talented. Thank you.
I don't think I started that. I think actually Aaron started that on one of the shows, and I've sort of adopted it, so it's kind of fun. It's part of my shtick, you know. That's the way this works. So
called much worse, but yeah, it's okay. Nice.
and we're not doing a Linux Outlaws show this time. That was a fun show. It was a really fun show. Got a lot of good feedback on that. That was wonderful and cool. And where are you speaking to us from? I think probably Liverpool.
Yeah, my usual hideout in Liverpool. Don't be fooled by the cactuses behind me here, if I can get my thumb in the right place for the video people. A few cactuses on the thing. They're not native to this area. That's where they're in pots. So I'm in Liverpool in the UK, which is not hot enough to grow cactuses outside particularly.
And I am actually out in just north of Fort Lauderdale. I think it's Pomona Beach, something like that. And I'm on the 10th floor. It's a beautiful view. I'm going to hold this up for a second. Let's see if I can get that in the video there. That's actually a picture of what I'm looking at right now, which is really, really amazing. I'm out here for 11 days to basically stage myself as I'm on my way to Dragon Con in a week and a half. And I figured I'd start out by being on the East Coast so that I would be able to have a really short flight coming up instead of flying all the way from the West Coast over to here. So I am currently on the road. I'm on a possibly dicey Wi-Fi, so there might be a few dropouts occasionally and stuff like that. But the show is not about us. The show is about the guest and the project they want to talk about. Today, no exception to that. Our guest today is scrolling the wrong place. I should be more prepared than this. Our show today Yeah, Philip, there we go. That's the word. Philip Reisner, there we go. And we're going to be talking about LynStore, which is a project that is going to do – well, here, I have the text right here. It's High Availability DRDB. So it's an open source management tool designed to manage block storage devices for large Linux server clusters. And its primary use case is currently to provide persistent Linux block storage for Kubernetes and OpenShift environments. So – first off, when you have a cluster of machines, they all have to talk to disk, and you want the disk to be high performance and high availability. And those come as a consequence of having software that replicates data across multiple machines and replicates data in a way that if one of the machines goes down, you can recover the data and move all the rest of the data around so it still has the same number of replications. High availability is coming is that, and then high performance is because each machine has access to some part of the data directly so that you can get local access instead of just doing everything over the net. That's about all I know about this so far. Dan, can you fill in anything else?
I've had a quick look at it, and I am interested in the comparisons to some of the other options out there. Like I've been doing some stuff with ZFS or ZFS, as you guys call it, over there recently. Sure. So that'd be interesting. And there's Ceph and all kinds of other things that we could talk about. But it looks really interesting. It's in the Linux kernel, so that's a really good sign. And I'd look forward to learning more about it.
Well, there's no reason not to bring on our guests, so let's go ahead and bring on Philip. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dan. Good to be here.
Okay. Hi, and where are you speaking to us from?
I'm located in Austria, so that's only a little bit south of Germany, and our native language here is German, but, well, let's do the show in English, right?
Yes, right.
That would be good for us, yeah.
Yeah, I took exactly 1 year of German in high school, and the first time I went to Germany 30 years later, I had no idea. All I could do was tell the time, and I went, well, that's stupid, my My phone tells me what time it is. That's the only thing I remember how to say in German. So what a waste of time. I wish I'd taken 2 years of Spanish instead. I would have been that much further ahead in most of my travels. So let's talk about Lindstor. So what problem are people solving when they're reaching for Lindstor?
Yeah, okay. So why did we do it, right? Why did we started it? So we are coming from the Linux side, right? So I have personally been working on DAVD, that's this replication driver for Linux, and a version of it is upstream, and the most recent version is not upstream, but we will merge it upstream, Linux upstream at some day.
Sure.
So we are coming from this Linux background, and we understand the challenges that are out there to solve when it comes to software-defined storage. And when we looked at the solutions that were around, and you already mentioned Ceph, for example, we got the feeling, well, Ceph is really great. It is an object store, and then on top of the object store, you add a layer that gives it block semantics again. And then this is used to do I/O for virtual machines. And we just had the idea, well, we don't like the idea to put an object layer in between. So what we want to do, or what we are doing, is that we take the Linux I/O stack, which works for block devices as it is, and we leverage on all the features that this block I/O stack has, like LVM, the Linux Volume Manager, like the software RAID code, like Bcache and DMcache, that are two functions that allow you to use SSDs as caches for hard disks, right? And CFS or ZFS. And we're building on these building blocks. And if necessary, we're also building on the building block we know very well, which is DAVD. And yeah, what's one property of all these building blocks is that they are compatible on the data plane. So you can mix and match them as you need it, right? So you can put an LVM on top of a RAID, on top of a software RAID. But if you really want to do, you can also create a software RAID out of two logic volumes. So they're all compatible on that layer. But in case you have used them, you noticed that all these things come with their own management tools, right? So there are the LVM commands to manage LVM. There is MD RAID for the software RAID and so on. So there are many tools, right? And what Lindstor is about is Lindstor is a distributed system. So you have daemons running on a bunch of nodes. And these daemons will configure these building blocks we have on Linux to create something what you need in that moment. And so this distributed system comes with an API, and then we have connectors from that API to, let's say, Kubernetes. But we also have a connector to OpenStack Cinder, and we have one to Proxmox, and we will create more as projects are around that can make use of software-defined storage.
So, cool. And let me make sure I understand what this is doing then, because I know probably a bit of our audience, their eyes are already glazed over just a little bit, so I'm going to see if I can kind of bring it back down to earth for most of us, including me. So ultimately, this is providing what would essentially be data blocks. So we would build a file from. So rather than something like Ceph that's trying to do something with objects, we're actually just going to present block 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 in a contiguous sequence. And it's up to the applications then to write stuff in and out of that. But what you're doing as well is you're replicating this on multiple machines, providing high availability and maybe high performance by having some of it distributed across multiple machines. Is that fair to say this is what it's doing?
Yeah, so we are working on block level. That's correct. And you are all using block devices when you use Linux, because you have your Linux root file system on some hard disk or SSD. And the hard disk or SSD is abstracted in Linux as a block device, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what Linstore presents you is, let's call it a virtual SSD or a virtual block device, hard
sure.
disk, right? And it creates that by replicating data over physical SSDs or hard disks, right? And
sure.
the main difference when we compare it to Ceph is that we built this data path with the building blocks that are in the Linux kernel. And then you mount the file system on top of it and maybe use it for a container, or you put the image of a virtual machine on it, and then you can use it for virtualization purposes, right?
Okay, and so would I... Does this improve performance then? I keep making up that because it's across multiple machines and they all have some form of local storage perhaps, that it's faster. But is this just about having high availability, or is it also about getting better performance?
Okay. Let's talk about the performance aspect. So the massive change we are facing recently is that the block devices got ways faster, right? When we look back at hard disk drives, we were talking about a few hundred IOPS. Then we had the SSDs, which we are still connecting through the traditional buses like SATA and SAS. And these SSDs mm-hmm. give you like thousands, maybe 10,000s of IOPS. So IOPS is mm-hmm. IO operations per second.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every recent laptop comes with an SSD these days. And then as this technology is so fast, the industry replaced the bus. We connect these SSDs to the host machine. And so then we enter the world of NVMe. So that's the abbreviation is for Non-Volatile Memory Express. It started out as a specification for a PCIe card. So the first NVMe drives were PCIe cards. And these things give you performance like up to 100,000 IOPS or maybe 200,000 IOPS.
Wow.
And so just remember back about a hard disk drive. So we are now 1,000 times faster than a hard disk drive, right? And this is not the end of the evolution. Now Intel came out with these Optane devices. And here we see IOPS up to a million IOPS per single Optane drive if it is connected by the NVMe bus. So this is the challenge in hardware. And when we look at Ceph, you need to understand it was created when hard disk drives were around. So it was built under the assumption we need to distribute the virtual block device over many hosts to get reasonable performance. Things have changed in the meantime. So you can get superb performance by just using a single NVMe device in a single server, or let's say two servers to have it redundant. So distributing it is no longer crucial to achieve high performance. What's crucial these days is to make your software faster, because now the main overhead is the software that sits in the data path. And here comes the reason why having an object layer in between that makes things more expensive, in the way every time you cross a 4 megabyte boundary, you have to look up a different object. So that's all code you execute in the data path. And with the current hardware constraints, it is more valuable to have this data path to be very cheap, you know, as little instructions as feasible. So what we do with Linstore and the software we are working on.
Sorry, I was just wanting to ask a bit about the history of like the project and how you did. You started the project then, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I started to work on DBD. That was back in the year 2000, actually. So that's quite some time back.
Yeah, I don't want to hazard a guess at your age, but were you a student then or something? But I'm guessing, judging by your possible age, I'm assuming you were. How did you come to start it? Were you kind of just out of college, or how does that work?
Yeah, so here I was studying computer science here in Vienna Technical University. And when you graduate from that, you need to do this diploma thesis. And for that, you select, you know, some topic and work on that for like 2 semesters. And I wanted to do something that's not just disappearing the library of the university, but that might be used in real world.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, I was looking around for topics, and then one of the institutes had the topic, well, do hard disk mirroring over the network. And when I saw it, I said, maybe, or I thought it's boring, but then I, you know, went home on the bus and thought about it and realized, oh, this is actually a good problem to solve, because it enables all this high availability without the need for shared storage. And shared storage in itself can be a single point of failure for HA system. So this is how I got into all this subject.
Yeah, and I guess at the time, I mean, obviously you couldn't know what was going to happen in the future, but I mean, we're now in a world where everything is we've got federated services, we've got all these different things. It's everything so closely kind of networked. Obviously, I'm going to use the buzzword here, but you know, the cloud and all that. This all relies on this thing that you're. That you've come to, you know, that you started. So is that a nice feeling to know that you were kind of ahead of the curve a little bit there?
Of course. Well, let me add a bit to that. So when I started to work on that, so, you know, networking technology was just going from 10 megabit per second to 100 megabit per second. And at that time, it was not yet considered feasible to do I/O over the network, just because network was even slower than hard disk drives. Okay, now, a few years later, we have now 10 gigabit Ethernet, like the standard in the data center, 100 gigabit Ethernet available, and I'm pretty sure things like 200 gigabit Ethernet or 200 gigabit InfiniBand is definitely in the standardization works. So network bandwidth is enormous, right? And so doing I/O over the network is now something that's absolutely reasonable these days.
And I noticed that you got into the, you're in the Linux kernel, and that, you know, was in, I think, 2009. There we go. Yeah, 2009, Linus Torvalds agreed to put it in the mainline kernel. So was that difficult process? Because I know, without getting too political about it, I know that it can be difficult to get the kernel developers to accept things sometimes and get them in. So was he keen on this, or did you get nice kind of responses from them?
Yeah, well, it was a difficult process. So I think we started like 3 years earlier, and we were completely clueless. So, you know, there are formal things like following the coding standard, you know, where to put the curly braces and where spaces are allowed and where not in the C source code. So you need to get that right. So that they even look at it. And and then at that point there was the Linus Torvalds gave out the direction, okay, everything that well, I'm not sure how to phrase it, but he said everything that is useful for a bigger audience should be on the mainline kernel. So because then this tree-wide changes also reaches those kind of drivers. And for sure there was discussions, but after we did our homework, like, you know, following the coding style, talking to the right people at conferences, the maintainer of the block subsystem, that's Jens Axbo, decided to take it. And yeah, then I still need to continue my learning process and following the exact procedures the kernel maintainers want to receive the patches, and that of course evolves also over time. But yeah, I like to work with these guys. They are really developers on the highest level on this planet.
Yeah, and they seem, I mean, I'm not a developer of any of that standard, so, but I have been on the Linux kernel mailing list a few times, which is infamous for its, for being quite hostile if you, as you say, don't follow the coding standards or you do things that they think are not very smart. But they're quite pragmatic, and if the solution is the best solution or a good solution, then they'll often put it in. So, but they accepting then? It sounds like on the whole they accepted that it was a good technical solution, and then they were happy to kind of move that into the kernel.
Yes, so I got accepted, and you know it's many different players, and all of them have their own opinions. But what counts is that it is in. The Linux kernel is one kind of how an open source project can be set up. So we have, you know, Linus Torvalds at the top, and he's the boss of everything, and then he has his deputies, and everything works in a network of trust, right? You establish your reputation, and that allows you to get patches and changes in, and that's a lot less formal than what we see in other projects like an OpenStack, where we have all these elections and very formal processes. I grew up with the Linux way of how it works. So maybe this is the reason why I like it.
Hey, so I wanted to jump in here because you were talking about, this is in the kernel, of course, already. Was a new protocol invented for Linstor, or was there already protocols to go machine to machine over the wire, transmitting and replicating data?
Yeah. Okay. So the data protocol we use that is DOBD. So this we invented for the data replication to build HA systems, starting back in the year 2001. Evolved over the time a lot, and now we use this as a data transport protocol. So that's there. And the Linstor part. That's all sitting in user space, and that's like the control plane. So that controls how these data paths are then set up. And yeah, Linstore became a big project pretty fast. So it is now more than 100,000 lines of code. Mm. And it is created by mainly by a team of four in working at Linbit. And yeah, they are doing a great job.
So tell me about the community then. So we have you have this project, you have this company Linbit. Is all the development being done by people that work for Linbit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me look at the two parts we're talking about, about DBD and Linstore. DBD is the kernel component, and as that, it is a pretty high, let's call it, entry hurdle, right? Because there are not so many developers out there which are familiar writing kernel code. And these days, you have that most kernel developers are employed by, you know, some Linux distributor or some other company having interest in some subsystem of Linux being developed. So they all follow their tasks, right? None of them is bored on a rainy Sunday and looking, hey, what cool stuff could I do? So the number of contributions in the DBD area is pretty low. From time to time, we engage with customers, and then the engineers realize, oh, that's all open source, and then they contribute something back. But that's rather small. So kind of contributions we get in if there are tree-wide changes in the Linux kernel, then these changes are, of course, also applied to the DBD driver. So that's our kind of contributions that reach us there. Yeah, and then when we look at the Linstore side, Linstore itself is developed in Java. And as such, it has, a much lower entry hurdle for developers to join. And we have seen interest, but at this point, not many actual contributions. I guess this is since Linstore is still new, but we have seen contributions in the form of packaging it in containers, and this DevOps automation around it. But I expect that we will see more contributions from outside Linbit to Linstore very soon.
Yeah, so is this the kind of thing, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the use case is for this, and especially since you have adapters for Kubernetes and OpenStack, is this the kind of thing that I would use for my auto-scaling when I'm rolling out, you know, more hits per second and I need to have more replicated storage or more high availability storage for something, say, sitting in AWS?
When you ask the question how to do storage for OpenStack, you will get very different answers depending on who you ask, right? So
we have another guest on the channel. Can you see if you can possibly? It sounds like a small child. Is there some way to?
Yes, my 5-year-old son sneaked in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he has escaped my wife and.
Oh, oh no!
Okay.
For that.
It's almost to the point where we can't hear you. So I'm just saying we really kind of need to take care of that. So if you can, all right, go ahead. Sorry, continue your answer, please. Sorry for interrupting.
Okay, help me a second to pick up the thread again. Where have you been?
Well, I was asking, would I reach for this if, say, I was doing something, say, auto scaling in AWS, or, you know, then it would talk to Kubernetes or OpenStack, whatever I'm doing to do my auto scaling, and then it would know how to attach more and more storage that's high availability to my application.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. OpenStack clusters or Kubernetes clusters, you can either use offerings on the public cloud, like in AWS or Google Compute Engine or Google Kubernetes Engine. Mm-hmm. And some companies decide that they want to have it on-premise, let's say for regular for reasons like, you know, they have to keep the data in their own data centers, blah, blah, blah. Regulation, right? And then you come to the question, how do I create a storage for my OpenStack or my Kubernetes? Mm-hmm. And there you will get very different answers depending on who you ask, right? So the traditional storage vendors want to sell you their storage boxes. And then you end up in the situation that you use an open source container orchestrator or open source infrastructure as a service orchestrator like OpenStack and proprietary storage in the backend. So This is okay for some users. Others want to go the open source way, right? And what we do is let's go the open source way. Let's build the whole storage tier also with open source tools. And when it comes to taking advantage of the performance of NVMe drives, there is even another good reason to go that way. Yeah, and how it works is, so you would either had a pool of dedicated nodes to do your storage, or you could go hyper-converged. So have, you know, have one kind of node, let's say you're using the x86 platform, and use the same pool of nodes to host the containers and to host the storage devices. And going hyperconverged has the advantage that if the placement is done clever, that read operations can be carried out without even touching the network, right? Because then you make sure that one replica of the volume is on a node where the container or the VM runs. So these are challenges we like to solve.
Awesome. And how is Linbit being funded?
We are self-funded. So it literally started with, you know, five founders, four others like me.
Yeah.
out of university, putting together, like, you know, a few thousand euros and starting the company and starting with, you know, earning nothing in the first few months.
Right.
And out of that, we are growing it slowly and organically since 2001. And today we are a company of 30 people, where 20 of us are located in Vienna, Austria, and 11 are located in or near Portland, Oregon.
Yay, my home, actually. So that's cool. Where's the money coming in from? Are you selling services? Are you selling consulting? Training? What's the deal?
The main business model is to sell support subscriptions.
Sure.
And with that, you get access to, you know, repositories where we package everything nicely in RPM or Debian packages. And you get access to the support system we run. So you can open tickets and, you know, different support levels. where we have a 24/7 schedule and answer your questions within an hour, all that kind of stuff. So this is the main income, the main source of income. And trainings and custom consultings, that's the smaller part of the business.
It must be convenient that having people in both Portland and Vienna that you can provide 24-hour coverage without having to keep people up in the middle of the night.
Exactly, exactly. So we tell our German-speaking customers, keep in mind if you open a ticket during the night, write it in English.
Yes, perfect, perfect. Mm. And what license did you choose and why?
So the kernel ports are GPL, just to be compatible with the Linux kernel, of course, and GPL version 2. And the user space parts, like Linstore, here we have GPL version 3. And just we do proper open source software, so GPL is our choice. And we don't like the BSD license since that's too liberal.
Okay, so, well, I agree with you. Like, not that we're going to specify licenses on here, but I like your license choice, shall I say. So I was looking at some of the information that you sent over, Philip, and I use Proxmox quite a lot at home. It's mainly just for my own home use, if I'm honest. But for anyone who doesn't know, Proxmox is a Debian-based distribution, which helps you to, well, makes it easy to manage things like KVM instances, LXC containers, and so on through their web interface. And they add some extra repos and stuff. But the reason I was mentioning it is there's an article on your site here about using Linstore on Proxmox VE. Now, my current setup is I've just recently changed from MDA DM, I don't know how you say that, like MADM or whatever, software RAID setup anyway, to ZFS. And it took me about 2 weeks to get it all working. Would I use Linstore instead of ZFS, or would that be on top of ZFS? Mm-hmm. And what would be the advantages of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we support... to use ZFS as a backend for Linstore. So if you would put Linstore in place, you have the choice to either use LVM or ZFS. And if you go with ZFS, then it does setvals in the back. And with Linstore, you would create let's call it a virtual pool that you call, let's say, two-way redundant. And if you have more than two nodes, you could also have a pool three-way redundant, right?
Okay,
and even if you have 10 nodes, let's assume you create two pools, two-way redundant, three-way redundant. If you happen to have hard disks and SSDs in all of your 10 nodes, you could create pools like two-way redundant on SSD, three-way redundant on SSD, two-way redundant on HDD, right?
Yeah.
And then
so it sounds a little bit like... Sorry, go on. No, sorry. Go on. I was just going to say it sounds a little bit like, and I'm conscious that you're in Austria as I say this, but like a Swiss Army knife almost. You know, that it's like it's allowing me, so I can see how you're saying it would make it more flexible, basically. In my home situation, I'm using a very limited set of hardware, so I haven't got tons of nodes and stuff, so it probably doesn't. Maybe I'm not seeing the advantages of it for me personally, but I can see what you mean. So if I had lots of different types of stories that I needed to talk to, Linstore would allow me to not worry about where it was or what kind of storage it was, but just, you know, see it as a transparent layer. Is that more accurate?
Yeah. That's a pretty accurate view of it. Yeah. And as you say, for most home users, it's good enough to have the data on a RAID set, right? But starting with small businesses, you worry about downtime, and then you prefer to have your data replicated. So if a power supply of a node fails, you don't need to replace that. But you can immediately restart the virtual machine on a, on another node in your setup, right?
Yeah, that is very cool. And very quickly, we talked about Ceph at the start, which is something I mentioned, which is an alternative for this. And I know that in Proxmox, Ceph seems to be quite heavily pushed. It's already in the graphical interface. You can just enable Ceph things. So is the goal maybe to try and get them to add Linstor as well? Because I know you can add it yourself, but it's not in the installer. I didn't see it in the installer.
Yeah, that's correct. So you need to keep in mind that our Proxmox connector is still very new. So as soon as everything is a little settled, we will for sure ask the Proxmox people if a bit more nice integration is possible. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so we've actually had this question a couple times in the chat room. We have a live chat room during the taping. Emily, I think is Emily the Strange, has a couple times, I think, tried to hint at what's, and I'll make it a bigger question than what she was asking. What's the authentication and authorization across the wire? Can someone be eavesdropping and see all the blocks going back and forth, or is there some sort of layer of encryption on top of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for the control part, so Linstor itself, that can use SSL. So, you know, because Linstor might send shared secrets and things over its connections. So here, SSL is possible. For the data plane itself, that's not encrypted. So think of it like an iSCSI, right? If you run iSCSI over an Ethernet and the attacker has gained the possibility to eavesdrop on this Ethernet segment, he will literally be able to capture all the reads and writes as they fly over the Ethernet segments. So the same is true for the DWD protocol. So what we do have is that the connection will be authenticated by a shared secret, and Linstor puts the shared secret at the end. So when the TCP connection for the data path is established, you know, that's only possible if the shared secret match. So that at least prevents an intruder to connect to the port and ask for every block, right? Because the intruder doesn't have the shared secret. But yeah, the data plane traffic is not encrypted as of now. Maybe a feature that comes a little down the road.
And this may be more a DRDB question than a Linstor question, but if you can also answer for me, because I'm curious, how does the failover and resynchronization work? What's the sort of methodology for that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so DBD itself is only a replication technology, so replicating data. In the old world, you would combine it with a cluster manager like Pacemaker. Some listeners might know the term Heartbeat, so that was even a before Pacemaker, and that would do then things like taking over the IP address, bringing up the IP address on a new node, activating the file system, restarting the service. And in the new world, when we have software-defined storage and, let's say, Proxmox or OpenStack, then it is this virtualization orchestration. In the case of Proxmox, it's Proxmox itself. You know, Proxmox sees, okay, one of the hypervisor nodes is dead. There was a VM running that is marked that this VM should be kept running. So what is Proxmox doing? It restarts the VM on one of the surviving hypervisors, and it gets access to the same data, and that's provided by DBD and Linstor.
Okay, and who else is in this space? I'm sure there's other people that have also wanted to solve the same problem. So who are you competing against, and what's your advantage?
So in the old world, when we think about DVD for HA, then the competitors are mainly from the proprietary space. So there was a there is a Veritas product. There's a product from a company called Now Sios. It started under the name SteelEye. So that are proprietary competitors. And they're still in the market since, you know, big organizations sometimes standardize on these products. So, and you know, that sometimes it comes from the Solaris heritage. And then they also use the same product for HA on their Linux installations. For this failover replication, I'm not aware of another open source solution. Now when we look at software-defined storage, where we are active with Linstore, then there is, of course, Ceph. We mentioned that multiple times. To a certain extent, also ClusterFS is active in that area. So these are the main open source players. There is a project from Germany called BGFS. That's a file system. You can use that for similar purposes. It's open source, but has a license that is a little bit more restrictive. So let's say Debian would not include it.
Okay. Hey, we're almost out of time, but is there anything that we didn't ask yet that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
You covered it pretty well.
We try. And unfortunately, that's a difficult question to answer. Now, that's why I was saving it for the end. Well, I have to save it for the end because otherwise it wouldn't make any sense. But it's like you have to think about all the things. Yeah, let's ask that at the beginning. Is there anything we haven't asked yet that you want to talk about? Yeah. No. But I mean, it's like so the problem is to answer that question, you have to think of all the things we talked about, and then you have to do a set subtraction of all the things you wanted to talk about. That's tough to do in a few seconds.
So you need a diff. You need a diff thing, basically.
A diff. That would do it. Yeah. That would definitely do it. I do also want to ask, though, since this is an open source project, is there any kind of people that you want to ask our audience to see if they want to help work with this project that you're particularly lacking currently contributing to the project?
Okay. Yeah. So, yes, we run it as an open source project, but we also run it as a company, right?
Right.
So the most value we take out of the open source users is that they use our software and report if there's something wrong. So my ask is everybody out there who has a Proxmox and thinks about, replication over two nodes would be cool, please try our stuff. If there is something you don't like, come to our mailing list, shoot us a mail on the mailing list, get in touch on the IRC channel. Just tell us your experiences. From point of view of a company, we always care for our support customers first. And so sometimes we are not super responsive on the user mailing list, but usually there's one of us hangs out there and answers questions. And we see all of the comments and we take all this input, and that steers our development in the end, right?
Sure. So, all right. And so... I have to ask two required questions, or else my audience actually yells at me. So, what's your favorite text editor?
I am an old school Emacs guy.
Yay! Emacs! Yay! All right, good. That's good. That's good. Thank you very much for that answer. It's the first time in months I think somebody says Emacs. So that's wonderful. There's actually, I presume you mean GNU Emacs, of course, right? There's actually a little bit of Emacs. There's a little bit of me in every copy there. I wrote the pretty printer. The thing that takes a S expression and prints it out nicely indented, I wrote that. And Richard Stallman called it brilliant and wanted to make sure it became part of the core distribution. So there's a little bit of me in every Emacs, which is really nice. And now let's go with the other one.
I use your software every day.
That's great. That's great. That is awesome. So I can't say the same for your software yet. All I have is a single machine, so I really don't need replication. But maybe someday I'll have a big cluster somewhere. Now the other question is, what's your favorite scripting language?
Nowadays Python.
Okay.
I have to admit I'm coming from Perl.
Yay! Yay! Another one! I want another one! Yay! I'll take that as a point. I'll take that as a point in my column. Yes.
He did say coming from Perl, Randall. That implies going away from it.
Yeah. when you look at scripts as growing, you know, they get so ugly in Perl, and Python keeps.
Okay.
You have to admit that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, Philip, it's been great having you on the show talking about Linstore, and hopefully for the people for whom this is appropriate, they'll look at it as a reasonable solution for the problem space, and appreciate you chatting with us today.
Thank you, Randall. Thank you. It was a great time, Dan, here.
Thank you. Yeah. Great. Great. Thanks. That was Philip Reiser talking to us about Linstore. What do you think there, Dan?
Yeah, really interesting. I think, like you just said, Randall, about the whole, the need for it. I mean, I can see totally why it's in enterprise and so on. And this is really the sort of thing that Aaron would have been really good for, actually, because he does a lot of the distributed storage stuff. At home, I was talking about Proxmox. I've got basically one node in my house. So as great as this seems, I don't know how I would utilize it. But having said that, I can see why. If I'm using Proxmox essentially as like a sledgehammer to crack a walnut, as we say over here, for my home setup for VMs and stuff. But if I were in a data center, I can totally see why this would be really useful. And interesting that there aren't really a lot of. So it's interesting that he was saying there are no other open source competitors, because that's it's really good that they're in this space then, because it sounds as though it's quite an important project.
Well, you think the people that are building out the OpenStack and Kubernetes world would have something like this already in place, but it sounds like it's an adapter that fits in that, managing the storage for that. That sounds pretty cool. Anyway, let's go ahead and wrap up the show, which means I'm going to start talking about who's coming up next, which is next week. We have, and I'll be right in this very same location again, looking out at the very same ocean. Well, is it ever the same ocean twice? No. Well, the same named ocean. How about that? That'll work. Atlantic. Coming up next week is Hacks, which is an open source tool aiming to make online course creation accessible to all instructors. I hope by all they mean also me, because I do want to do some more online stuff, and it sounds like this would help me out. Following that, we have the first of our series of crypto question or crypto shows, Monero, which is cryptocurrency, private, untraceable, and fungible. So that'll be fun. Aion, who canceled on us at the last minute a few weeks ago, is coming back. That's a multi-tier system designed to address unsolved questions of scalability and interoperability in blockchain networks. So that's two blockchain shows in a row. Sanoid is Aaron, I believe, is actually going to be the host on this show. It's a policy-driven snapshot management and replication tools, and currently using ZFS, I'll pronounce it your way, for underlying next-gen storage with explicit plans to support ButterFS when ButterFS becomes more reliable. Well, that could be a while. And primarily intended for Linux, but BSD is supported and reasonably frequently tested. Just out of the schedule since the last time I did the show is Vadin, which is a Java-based web development platform. They still make these things? I think they started this back in 2000. So, yeah, but apparently they're still doing it. They're still doing Java on a web. All right, and following that will be Vicky Brasseur, who is going to talk to us about contributing to open source in general, but she has a new book out. So I saw her at It was the Pearl Conference, I guess, a few weeks ago, and she did one of the keynotes, and it was on the importance of the ecosystem, how we're actually poisoning the ecosystem for some projects, possibly even including Pearl, but basically how not to do that by welcoming new people and being more tolerant of people's initial naivety and things like that. Just added a schedule as well since last week. We have Sway. Sway, and I don't understand all this because I don't run Linux, but Sway is a tiling Wayland compositor and drop-in replacement for the i3 window manager for X11. And it works with your existing i3 configuration and supports most of i3's features, plus a few extras. So I run OS 10. Is it OS 10 anymore? No, it's Mac OS. I run Mac OS on my Mac. So I don't know anything about this stuff, but hopefully we'll get somebody on with some Linux experience and some X11 experience to basically tell me more about what that all means. So that's who's coming up. We got you can go to the big spreadsheet from the homepage of the show, twit.tv/floss. And if you have any other suggestions, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me. That's how most of these got on the schedule here. And especially if it's not cryptocurrency. I don't want to do any more crypto shows until the end of the year if I can help it. We'll see if I can make good on that promise, except for these two that are coming up. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We take a number of questions from there. Emily the Strange was kind enough to give us a couple questions for today. A couple others chimed in too, but I think we're okay. We follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. I'm plugging so far that I was on Software Engineering Daily. It's an audio podcast on July 11th, back a little ways. If you just Google, I couldn't find a short link for this. So if you just Google my name and Software Engineering Daily, I did a one-hour show on Flutter and why Flutter is important to me and why it's important to everyone. I'll be at Dragon Con coming up in the next weekend, I guess. Yeah, not this weekend, but next weekend, right? Labor Day weekend. So if you're there, please come up and say hi and say you're a listener of the show. That'll be really nice for me to meet some of my audience. I've got five sessions there. I'm on the EFF track, five different sessions. Most of them are panels, but I'm doing my Flutter talk there again. I'm at All Things Open in Raleigh, North Carolina in October. I am both press and speaker there. I'm actually doing my Flutter talk there as well. It just got accepted, which is really nice. I'm at Siegel, which we had the maker, the guy. For the show on this show,
that guy
that was from Seattle, right? It's a Seattle Linux show. The other guy. See, I'll be there in November, and I just got invited to go as press to KubeCon in December. So all things Kubernetes. So that'll be a lot of fun, and that's also in Seattle as well. So I'm going to be heading to Seattle twice, about a month apart, which is great because my brother lives like 2/3 of the way up there. So I'll be able to see him and my mom on my way up and down twice. So it'll be really great. All right, so that's all I have to cover so far. Dan, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, actually, it's quite a significant day, actually. I just launched a new podcast last night, funnily enough, which is called Tales. Yeah, it's called Tales of the Unattested, which is I was really proud of that kind of punish name. But basically, it's a confessional podcast where people can send us their confessions anonymously, and we talk about them. My friend Caroline and I talk about them, and it's very kind of fun and silly and all the rest of it. But it's an interesting show. During the first show, we talked about our favorite funerals we've ever been to. So it's a bit of a strange show, but it's very very interesting and funny, and lots of comic book references and other stuff in there. So if you want to find it, the first episode just came out last night, as I said. If you either search for Tales of the Unattested or my name, if you go to danlynch.org, which is on the thing there, or look at my Twitter, you can find it on there. And the web address is unattested.podfactory.org. But keep an eye on my Twitter and other things, and you can find it on there. Other than that, I actually had a really good chat with Simon Phipps, at the weekend in person in Sheffield. I went to Og Camp. And Simon's the treasurer for Og Camp now. So he turned up and he had this Og Camp crew shirt on. And I was thinking, what are you doing here? And then I noticed he had a crew shirt on. So we had a good 20, 30 minute discussion about licenses and other things. Mm. So lots of exciting stuff there. So keep up with Twitter and other things if you want to know what I'm doing. And check out the new podcast.
Are you also going to spin off a show from Unattested to be Tales of the Unit Tested? Talk about testing.
Ooh. That could be a software one, couldn't it? Yeah, that's a really good idea. Yeah. We could do. Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that later.
Tales of the Unit Tested. Yeah, that would be a great misspelling of that. Well, Dan, thanks for being on the show once again and helping me out, because this is area obviously I was sort of struggling with a little bit, and you apparently had slightly more experience with. So that was nice. Always handy when that works out. And also just always, it's always handy to have a co-host for this show, because occasionally I get stuck and need to go review things real quickly. And people don't know this, but behind the scenes, that's what we do a lot of. So we're actually handing off back and forth as we each get stuck. The other one takes over for a while, and we basically call it regrouping in our back chat room. So that's great. So Dan, thanks once again. And we'll see you all again next week from this very same location on Floss Weekly.